What happens when we face difficult conversations? These conversations can heal. They can foster forgiveness. They can inspire and change perspective. Lean into these stories and discussions. I think both our guests and our listeners will find value in them. And selfishly, I know I will too. All right, everyone. Welcome back to this episode of Lean In with Dr. Jabron Pasha. I am Jabron Pasha, and I am here with what I will call a special guest, Ms. Saeed, who I've known for quite a while. I've known her family for quite a while. Her brother is literally one of the best human beings I know. And she comes from that family, which means she is also quite a human being. And I'm really excited to chat with her today about the work she has really dedicated her life to so far. She's young, but she's done a lot. And before I get into a little bit more about her, I just want to say welcome, Almas, and thank you for getting up at 8:30 and earlier on the West Coast to record on a Saturday with me.
Jabron, I'm so privileged to be with you. I would wake up at any time.
Thank you.
To share some space with you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Almas is the Vice President of Public Partnerships at Liberty Hill Foundation. She brings 15 years of experience to this new job at this foundation. She's worked at the intersection of organizing, legislative policy change and litigation, and housing equity, workers' rights, and immigrant justice. Her previous job, she served as the Deputy Director of Programs at the California Immigrant Policy Center. She steered critical campaigns to ensure health access, worker protections, and helped to mitigate the impact of immigration enforcement for California's undocumented communities. And I have so many questions, and I'm so glad to talk about the work that you've done because we haven't had these conversations yet on Lean In. And so the first question I have for you, and I really like to ask this question of everyone, is how did you get into this space?
You know, Kansas was incredibly formative for what I ended up doing with my career. I didn't necessarily know that at the time. We immigrated to Kansas in the early 80s. And, you know, everything from making meaning of community, finding people that look like us, and then kind of the global political scene, the country was really focused on the war on terror. People who looked like my father and the uncles who raised me were also the enemies on TV. So, you know, making meaning of where our place was in the United States became a very formative question for me very early. I had always been interested in policy and law. I thought if you worked for political electives, you would just like change the thing. But it turns out it's far more complicated than that. And, you know, my work took me abroad for some time, but importantly, it also took me to Congress, where I served two members of Congress and later a governor. And I was like, oh, this is all very politically driven. Like, this is much more complicated than writing some laws and changing things for the better. I went to law school quite late, actually, in part driven by trying to really understand what tools I could use to make long-term change. But as a new lawyer, I was exposed to deep community organizing. And I know that we talk about that a lot. And, you know, President Obama kind of popularized this term of community organizing, and we don't really actually know what that means sometimes. For me, what it means is top-down policy tends not to work. Community-driven, focused organizing and building with leaders in a community that are most impacted by an issue. You know, my work has spanned everything from housing justice and eviction protection to workers' rights, particularly domestic workers, and more recently, undocumented communities in California. And each of these communities has something to say about the policies that impact them day to day. But we don't really stop to figure out what that impact looks like or how to change things to make sure people have a voice at the table. So I'm really like in awe of young people who have driven, for example, the undocumented immigrant movement in this country. It resulted in policies like DACA, right, for unaccompanied minors or young people who came to this country not knowing their status. And now it's subject to some criticism, but the movement that created the infrastructure for changes like this ushered in a whole new conversation about what is possible. So I like to tell people that I'm a lawyer by training and an organizer at heart, and that my job is to dream what's possible and build it with a focus on making communities' lives better.
You know, the way that I kind of see it is you going to law school provided you with the tools necessary to do the work that you were put here to do.
Yes. Lawyers who are listening to this are going to bristle. I think of my law degree as like an electrician's degree or a plumbing degree. Like, there are some skills that I need to understand policy, to review law. I've represented people in court before, but those are tools. It's not the end result. You know, it's not the thing. The thing is building systems, institutions, communities, community infrastructure, so that way we can build towards equity.
So one thing, Amasich, you may not know about me, one of my big, big interests is, you know, what makes certain communities less healthy than others. Health equity, social determinants of health. And so I'm naturally drawn to the work that you did at the California Immigrant Policy Center, the undocumented communities. And you were able to help get some really important legislation passed at the state level. Now, you want to tell us a little bit about that work?
Yes, I'm incredibly proud of what we did. So as a start, this work preceded me. And while I helped steer this campaign for 3+ years, the campaign was to ensure, regardless of your status, if you were eligible for Medi-Cal or state public health insurance, you were eligible. And the biggest exclusion from the program, both preceding and after the Affordable Care Act, were those people who were undocumented. California mobilized very, very quickly to try and close this gap. ACA passes in 2010. Implementation is between 2012 and 2014. By 2013, 2014, activists in California, led by community groups, by undocumented leaders, are saying, what about us? We make up 11%, 8 to 11%, depending on the year, of California's population. We work here. We're residents here. We contribute taxes. Not that we define people by their work, but these are our neighbors. You know, we shop with them. We go to church with them. We go to mosque with them. And status should not determine whether or not you get to see a doctor. So in 2016, 2017, the state moved to include, 2015 to 2016, the state moved to include children under the age of 18. And we weren't sure that there would be political will to move past that. There were certainly advocates who were sounding not just the alarm, but the need to ensure that people had access to basic health care, especially low-income communities. But building that political map and building that political will is a different thing. So when I started working on the campaign in 2018, we were really confronted with how to move the conversation forward. And the state did something kind of, I'm still grappling with it, Jerron. They were like, we're willing to have this conversation with you, but we're not going to do it all at once. We're going to do it incrementally, right? Mm. The difficulty with that is we had to make some decisions about who to advocate for first. And it was a very difficult thing to do because the instinct, you know, I come from politics. I was trained in some of these spaces. One's instinct is to think about the relationship, like which narrative can I tell that will be the most compelling?
Yeah, you've got to sell it.
Got to sell it. And that meant a little bit of like voyeuristic storytelling about the people most in need. You can understand like the dilemma that those of us who honestly want to represent people's interests and really didn't feel like the state needed to do it so incrementally, both gubernatorial leadership and the Assembly and Senate kept pointing to concerns around the budget. And if we do this all at once, what happens to the budget? But California, you know, has had the surplus and the money. But this is where we were, you know, this is where the campaign was. And so there was a bit of a conversation about who to focus on first. And we couldn't decide. This is a community-based coalition, statewide coalition. Over 40 groups are in that space. And while I worked on the policy side and did the interface with Sacramento, it was my responsibility, right, with my team to work with organizations to figure out where the priorities were and who they wanted to focus on. The community really came down to asking us to focus on elders. And I'll tell you that, so people over 65, undocumented communities over 65, the population of undocumented elders in California is among the highest in the country. And it is sort of a public health concern that we should have as a country, because in Texas, California, Illinois, on the East Coast, we have undocumented elders who don't have access to basic healthcare or income. And we're not really having a conversation about how to take care of this community, because they were like the first. So, you know, things like retirement and a bit of a safety net doesn't necessarily exist. The political temperature, what we were getting from Sacramento was that there was some appetite to cover young adults, to align it with the Affordable Care Act, which provided, you know, coverage up until you were 26 for like, right, like your parents could cover you until the age of 26. And for some reason, that symmetry really spoke to political leaders. I don't know why. It's not exactly the same thing. And we found ourselves in a little bit of a conundrum, because we knew we could get young adults and the community was telling us elders. We moved both. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know in retrospect if it was like the right decision, because the risk of that would have been we got nothing.
Right.
If you're bifurcated and focused on a target like this. That year we got young adults. The year after, we got seniors. And I have to tell you, we put everything out on the floor for these 2 years of the campaign. Like, our focus was to tell the stories of people who did not have healthcare and what that meant for their lives in a moment when Trump was in office. And Trump was no gift to us, right? Like, I do not think that we are better if we suffer. But what Trump and the White House did do for a state like California is that people's chins were up. You feel me? Like, yeah, they were sure. Like, we have to do something to show that we are not in line with what's happening in DC, like create a bit of a vibranium wall over the state, you know? Mm-hmm. And we were able to tell stories in a compelling way, to move the narrative such that Governor Newsom in particular, who was just like really concerned about the political fallout of moving this plus budget, we were really able, I think, to move the campaign to get these two bookends of the population. In January of this year, so just a few weeks ago, Governor Newsom announced he in his budget, his early budget, it still has to be advocated for and passed, that he would cover the rest of adults. So last year, we got 55 and over. This year, the governor has committed to covering everyone from the ages of 27 to 54. It would make California the first state in the country to cover everyone who's low income and undocumented and ensure their access to Medi-Cal. It is unprecedented. It makes me very proud and a little emotional.
That's incredible. And, you know, I'm by no means anywhere near an expert on policy, and I'm really just starting to kind of cut my teeth in the area. But one thing that I've at least heard along my journey to kind of learn as much as I can is that, sure, you know, it's important to try to do the right thing, right? And it's important to try to bring legislation because it feels like the right thing to do. But it also seems that there needs to be an economic case for almost any bill that's going to be passed. What was the economic case that you all were able to leverage for the state to get this work done?
Well, it was a couple of things. That first, an aging population. Well, the pandemic. Let me start with the pandemic. I keep forgetting that we're still in a pandemic. The public health costs to uninsured people in a surge of the coronavirus pandemic. And then, you know, we didn't anticipate staying in this moment as long as we have, but here we are. An incredible drain on the emergency system, the emergency health system. And so I think there was a commitment to reduce both the burden on the healthcare system, but also the cost, because you know that when someone goes into the ER to get care, it is a far more expensive, intensive, and difficult thing to do than if they never got sick in the first place. The second economic, I think, argument that was very compelling, especially to electeds in more conservative places like the Central Valley, where sometimes it's really hard, despite, you know, farm workers, the large community of undocumented workers that are literally doing all of the labor for, you know, from farm to table, basically, in the Central Valley. Sometimes those electeds are a bit more conservative. The argument, in addition to supporting communities during the pandemic, that was quite compelling, was the fact that undocumented immigrants aren't going anywhere and are aging. And if we are not kind of thoughtful about how they get care early on, the system is going to be absorbing the cost of that healthcare, in part because of this provision that is in every state, which is that emergency services are available to anyone. You cannot be turned away by an ER if you have an emergent or urgent issue that is a risk to your life because of your status. Now, some states get very difficult about how they define what emergency is. And that I feel like is a different podcast that I was on to come talk to you about, because we've heard of people being rejected at the door because they weren't like, they could have surgery on a Friday and it was Wednesday. But that is a very costly endeavor for a state like California. And, you know, the third piece of this that's very important that was part of my education is that California is privileged to have a surplus every year, despite, you know, kind of people making fun of like the high cost of California or, you know, the economy not like working because it's so expensive to live here and, you know, the drain of tech. We're doing okay. And thankfully, we come from the state has like kind of a vision about what it means to include everyone that I wish I could export to some other places. So those three things were kind of the economic case we write.
Well, needless to say, I'm so happy that you all were able to get this legislation passed. And I'm actually just finishing up a book called The Political Determinants of Health. It's by a gentleman named Daniel Dawes out of Morehouse Medical School. And essentially what he says is, look, you know, health inequities and social determinants of health are all related to policy and politics. And the reason that people are healthier than others and the reason that others are less healthy are absolutely correlated to policies being passed or policies not being passed. And I think this work that you all have done is a great example of how this is going to help improve the health of a large, large community.
I appreciate that. You know, your race, your status, where you live, your housing, the quality of your housing, your job, all of that deeply impacts your overall health, how long you live. And that, in a moment where we are all trying to survive in a pandemic, that should really give us pause. Like, I'm a stubborn believer that we can create a social contract that includes everyone in this country. You know, my concern a little bit about the strategy that California and other states have taken is that if you have a country where states are doing this on their own without the onus on the federal government, it creates deep disparities regionally that can really harm communities in the long run. If you happen to live in the Midwest or the South, where we've had just very difficult traction moving this conversation, I've done technical assistance and work across other states. We have some momentum on the East Coast and places like Illinois, but the door is getting shut on us in other regions. And I think the challenge that we're coming out of, you know, kind of the political partisanship that we're seeing at the moment is that states just go insular and they're like, we're going to just take care of this. Everything from reproductive healthcare access to basic preventative care for certain communities. You shouldn't have access to it because of where you live. You know, it should really be something that we value as a country. But this is where we are. And, you know, I'm trained as like kind of a a political leverage pusher. And this is sort of where we're able to do the thing. But my dream would be to go do this in the South or go do this someplace else. I'm recently in philanthropy where my focus is to make government work for everyone and trying to get money into communities. Like LA is different. LA is on everyone's map. Everyone's talking about Los Angeles. But, you know, here in California, we have a lot of regional diversity and just trying to get resources and money into community organizations and spaces that don't have it is my focus. But at the moment, but I think it would be pretty great to see the movement and work that we did in California happening in other regions. And more importantly, at the federal level, so we don't have to do all this work piecemeal.
Well, there's a couple other things I want to talk about as we kind of wind down here. And one has to do with a book that we actually read at our faculty book club called The Undocumented. It's a wonderful book. And I know you, and I wasn't surprised to ask to hear that you have read it as well. It's by Carla Cornejo Villavicencio. And she was an undocumented citizen who attended Harvard, which is, you know, that's hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. And really the premise for the book, which I think is important to kind of tease out here, was really about the value that society places on people based on what they think they bring to the society, right? And she said, hey, this book isn't about what we've all learned to know of what we call the dreamers, right? Those undocumented community members who become lawyers and doctors and start businesses, right? We know how society tends to value them in ways that they might value, in ways that they don't value someone who is in construction or in other jobs, right? What were your thoughts about that book? And did this concept come into play with the work you were doing over in California?
I'm so glad that you highlighted the undocumented Americans, in part because of exactly what you said. This narrative that we have around those immigrants that are worthy and those immigrants that aren't worthy has been central to dismantling that has been central to my thinking for the last few years, and also in building movements in places like California to really grapple with, can we recognize people's humanity without going to like what their work or whether they're smart enough or have the skills to get into elite colleges. I mean, if that was the assessment in the test, Jabron, I wouldn't have made it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't have, if my story was a little bit different, if my life had been a little bit different, the results of my life would have been very, very, very not what they have been. I think the campaign really focused on telling the story of families and people. So I wanted to share one story that really was formative for me. As I started the campaign in 2018, I met the grandchildren of two people who had been a farm worker, another a domestic worker their entire lives, and diabetes, both struggled with diabetes. And in 2017, after Trump's election, the only way to get affordable insulin was to cross the border into Tijuana. The reason I never got to meet these young people's grandparents is because they went to Tijuana and never, ever came back. They had lived in the country for 32 years between San Diego and the Central Valley as seasonal farm workers and domestic workers as they could. And I tell that story often, you know, in sharing the reason and the motivation for the campaign, as well as like just to explain that health inequity also separates families. You don't need a wall. You can have policies like this that these two young people had to go live with other extended family. They were displaced, had to find a new place to live because the grandparents could not come back into the country. And then the grandparents had to resettle, you know, south of the border. And they hadn't lived there in 30 years. It's incredibly sad. And also not necessarily a story about undocumented young people who, you know, went to elite schools and became deep professionals. I think recognizing everyone's humanity was really what drove the campaign. And it was very central to the campaign. We created a film. Actually, I would encourage people to go see it. You can find it on the Google, on Vimeo. It's available to everyone, called Coverage. And I'm happy to share the link with you afterwards that just tells the story of undocumented people trying to fight for their ability to see a doctor. Yeah, I mean, you raise a really good point. I really struggle with the broader frame that gets political traction that some immigrants are worthy of care and others aren't. I'm really glad that you raised the point because it is what is motivating us to try to change the way people talk about immigrant communities. You know, my family came, we were not undocumented, but the frame around good Muslim versus bad Muslim, right? That immigrant narrative that was so central to the way that I was raised and the way that I grew up, it feels very relevant and somewhat similar. Like, are you a good Muslim who's worthy of being here? And unfortunately, the way that we have built policy, like we focus on children, we focus on young people, we focus on those who can go to the military and serve, who can go to college. For low-income communities, this is like a not common reality, right? People are struggling to be solvent and be well. The other thing that I would be remiss if I didn't say is that all work is skilled work. From our farm workers to our domestic workers who are excluded from federal labor protections, who take care of our children, who clean our homes, who take care of our elders, right? Who grow our food, the kind of work that we dismiss, even service workers. In the pandemic, we wouldn't be here without service workers. We don't talk about skill the right way because this is a country that struggles with people who are poor. So, you know, let's have a different conversation about the safety net and how we're recognizing people's humanity and their right to thrive.
Absolutely. Well, as we kind of wrap things up, I do want to hear a little bit about what your plans are at your brand spanking new position at Liberty Hill.
Liberty, that's so kind of you to ask. So Liberty Hill is one of the largest philanthropic foundations in California. My portfolio focuses on getting the county and the state and the city to invest in housing, environmental justice work. I'm going to talk about two campaigns that are taking up a lot of my time at the moment, and also ensuring that people have access to due process. So LA, as of this week, is the first big city in the country, I think, at least it's historic for LA to stop drilling. People don't know this, but there are oil reserves all around the city and county of LA. And this week, the city of LA passed an ordinance that would stop all oil drilling, which happens in low-income communities of color, largely Black communities, and it's incredibly dangerous for the environment. So I work at a place that funded that entire campaign, and I'm coming at the tail end because I just started, but it's incredible to see the work that the community did to get here. And, you know, ensuring that people have legal counsel when they're being subject to eviction. In our conversation, I focused a lot on immigrant rights, but I started in housing justice as a litigator and an eviction defense lawyer representing people who are losing their housing. And the project and work that we're doing in LA is to ensure that every single person has a lawyer. We call it the Right to Counsel campaign. In this moment, and I know that people think that their eviction, there was like an eviction moratorium and no one got evicted, and some places that moratorium is still in place. A lot of people are being subject to displacement and eviction. They are losing their housing in large part because of non-payment, even though there are protections in place because, well, you know, landlords can be unscrupulous. So we are working very hard to ensure that people know their rights and have a lawyer. I work with county and state and local government to make sure that they're putting money in the right places, and then I'm able to give it to organizers. I have the best job in the world right now. I'm just like, you invest here and I'm going to go give it to people who don't have it. But it is a huge departure for me. I've been in the field for 15 plus years, 20 years maybe, if counting time abroad. And so I'm learning, you know, I'm learning a new thing.
Which is always exciting, right? I always appreciate the challenge that comes with learning to do some new stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I am trying. I never anticipated being in philanthropy. I think, you know, we can have a conversation about its value and how problematic it can be. But, you know, I've also learned that these institutions exist. And so our job is to find our place in them and do good work.
Well, I'm excited for your new endeavors. I'm more excited to be able to share the work that you've done and your dedication to really to humanity, honestly, with my audience, however small or large that audience may be. I truly love you and your family. I am really proud to know you all, and can't thank you enough for the time you've given me this morning and for really your the dedication of your life to helping people.
Thank you so much, Jerron. And I'm so privileged to have had this opportunity to speak with you both about the breadth of what you've been doing and my own work, but also get a little deep on health access and healthcare access. I know how much you feel that. I'm not, you know, in the field, but it's such a strong calling for us to work together to do something that ensures people, you know, are healthy and can thrive. We all deserve that. And I'm so grateful to have you out in the world sharing this message.
Let me know your thoughts about this episode. I'm easy to reach on Twitter at Jerron Pasha, on Instagram at What Medicine Did, and on unlockingimplicitbias.com. Thanks for leaning in with me.